Part 3 of 6 from set number 1009, C.G. Jung's 7 Sermons. This is a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Cosmic Opposites, Gnostic Creative Dualism Expressed Psychologically.
And with that, I think we can address this evening's topic, this being within the series of commentaries about the 7 Sermons to the Dead. As you have noted probably earlier, I do not quote in the lectures inevitably the entire text of the sermons, because it's quite lengthy, but only the ones that I feel that can be more readily highlighted for our purposes. But if you would like to have the entire text of the sermons, as well as perhaps my much longer commentaries to them, they are still available in my book that was published years ago, remained in print ever since, The Gnostic Jung and the 7 Sermons to the Dead. If I may say so myself, it wasn't very badly written. truly, it was my first major book, and I truly poured into it everything that was within my psyche at that particular time. I was so worn out and so wrung out afterwards that I outwardly and inwardly resembled a lemon that had been used for the purpose of a large quantity of lemonade. So I don't know whether that's a recommendation or not. Maybe that will sour you on the prospect of getting the book. But it was really not a bad book. In any event, now we are addressing it in a somewhat different way. And we have, in the course of our earlier talks, dealt with the first, the second, and the third sermon. And we saw that Jung is unfolding in the 7 sermons a kind of, quintessential skeletal structure of his Gnostic psychology. And in so doing, in this poetic treatise written very much in the style and with much of the terminology of second or third century Gnosticism, he began with the pleroma, with the ultimate ground of being, with the transcendental reality, about which, by his own admission, very little can be said, but he wrote one of the longest sermons about that, nevertheless, even though so little can be said about it, because that's the way those things usually go. And then, sort of in descending order now, we are dealing with the various emanations, let's say, of the original reality, and each one of these has some relevance to Jung's psychology, because as I quoted his statements from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections earlier, he had freely admitted that all of his subsequent work was contained in these initial insights, initial Imaginationen, as he called them in German. And we finished off last time with the awesome figure of Abraxas, which somehow really grabbed Jung particularly powerfully, and it is written in a most awe-inspiring and at times sort of downright frightening manner. And we indicated at that time that under Abraxas, Jung understands primarily the underlying power, the energy of universal being and of the human psyche that makes for the union of the opposites. The union of the opposites. And that indeed to accomplish such a task, whether within us or outside of us, takes a tremendous amount of force, and that force he represented as Abraxas. So it's a little different representation from the mythic figure of Abraxas as it appears in the Gnostic scriptures, at least the ones that we know of, yet compatible with them. Now, since we have encountered this downright Nietzschean description of that awesome figure that works for the union and reconciliation and the union with the opposites, it behooves us to have some glimpse of what these opposites are. What is it that Abraxas is uniting? And that is precisely the subject that is addressed both in the fourth and in the fifth sermon, which are the subject of our discussion this evening. So I will read now the portions of the fourth sermon, which we feel are of particular interest to us, and then we'll comment on them, and then, if time allows, I want to wind up with a sort of general statement, which I may continue with next time, of the true underlying relationship of Jung's teachings with Gnosticism, especially as it relates to the opposites, what people often in a pejorative manner refer to as the dualism of the Gnostics. But now the fourth sermon. Grumbling, the dead filled the room and said, "Speak to us about gods and devils, thou accursed one." You know, the dead, whoever they may be, are a sort of ill-tempered bunch. And every time, they always come back again, but they always excoriate, they always maltreat their teacher when they come. You know, come on, tell us about that. You know, this kind of nasty business. So now, here he teaches them in the fourth sermon. God the Son, S-U-N, is the highest good. The devil is the opposite. He mentioned this already prior to Abraxas. Thus you have two gods, a good one and a bad one. Sort of a little bit Zoroastrian in nature. Or people often call that Manichaean, while that is not really true Manichaeanism. But there are many great goods and many vast evils, and among them there are two god-devils, dash, combination, one of which is the burning one and the other the growing one. The burning one is Eros in his form as a flame. It shines and it devours. The growing one is the tree of life. Not the Kabbalistic one, incidentally. It grows green and it accumulates living matter while it grows. Eros flames up and then dies away. The tree of life, however, grows slowly and reaches stately stature throughout countless ages. Good and evil are united in the flame. Good and evil are united in the growth of the tree. Life and love oppose each other in their own divinity. Immeasurable like the host of stars is the number of gods and devils. Now, I use the term devil, other translators, and there are not too many, have used often demon, but Jung uses the word Teufel, which is the German word for devil. And therefore, while it may be off-putting to some, none of us like to hear too much about devils. As Father Brown, you know, Chesterton's chocolate-eating clerical detective, said at one time, somebody asked him, "Father Brown, do you believe in the devil?" And he said, "Of course I believe in the devil. Otherwise, I might have to believe that I am the devil myself." Which shows a little bit of sort of quasi-Jungian insight on the part of old G.K. Chesterton, you know. In any event, that's the word, so that's the one that I used. Every star is a god, and every space occupied by a star is a devil. And the emptiness of the whole is the pleroma, within which it all exists. The activity of the whole is Abraxas. Only the unreal opposes him. In any event, incidentally, for those who are interested in those matters, while it's of course highly metaphorical, but then so is everything along these lines, it is rather close to what the redoubtable Madame Blavatsky says in her Secret Doctrine, where she sort of uses as a synonym for what here is called the pleroma space, and by which she doesn't mean just really ordinary space, but an immeasurable duration within which these various opposites and the worlds and the universes arise and disappear. So Jung undoubtedly was familiar with Blavatsky, but I doubted that he took it from there. And more about all that a bit later. Then he goes on saying, "Blessed am I, the teacher, for it is granted unto me to know the multiplicity and diversity of the gods. Woe unto you, for you have substituted the oneness of God, with a capital G, for the diversity which cannot be resolved into the one. Through this you have created the torment of incomprehension, and the mutilation of the created world, the essence and law of which is diversity. How can you be true to your nature when you attempt to make one out of the many? What you do to the gods, that also befalls you. All of you are made thus the same, and in this way your nature also becomes mutilated. For the sake of man there may reign unity, but never for the sake of God, because there are many gods, but only few men. The gods are mighty, and they bear their diversity, because like the stars, they stand in solitude and are separated by vast distances one from the other. Humans are weak and cannot bear their own diversity, because they live close to each other and are desirous of company, so that they cannot bear their own distinct separateness. For the sake of salvation do I teach you that which is to be cast out, for the sake of which I myself have been cast out. The multiplicity of the gods equals the multiplicity of men. Countless gods are waiting to become men. Countless gods have already been men. Man is a partaker of the essence of the gods. He comes from the gods and goes to God," with the capital G again. And then he speaks some more of the light gods and the dark gods, and he concludes the sermon by saying, "There is no difference in the power of the heavenly and the earthly gods. The heavenly ones expand, the earthly ones diminish. Both directions stretch into infinity." Now we might as well take a look at some little exegetical ideas on these matters. So he speaks first of all of the big duality, which is almost like the duality that sort of is the most important. Perhaps it encompasses many of the others. Perhaps from this primordial duality emanate other dualities. And this he calls the burning one and the growing one. My mind, which is sort of infused with imagery from the tarot, this always brings to my mind the tarot card of the lovers in the Weight deck, executed by Pamela Coleman Smith, where you have the two lovers standing there. Each one stands in front of a tree. But the tree that is behind one of them, behind the man, has flames coming out of it. And the other one has fruit. So the burning one and the growing one. So this duality is taken roughly from the worldview of the ancient Greeks, believe it or not. Because the Greeks spoke of the two at what they called world spirits, and they are called Eros and Logos. Eros, Jung mentions the very name, in the Greek view or neopantheists. Now that's quite a number of adjectives. I'm really proud of that one. Who noisily swarm about not only in the twilight zone of the New Age, but in more normative locales of our culture as well. I think that's a great sentence. Now, in fact, the frequent reaction against these supposed features of Gnosticism is, I think, one of the best proofs of the real orientation of our culture. Insult the God of their fathers and people won't bat an eye. But cast doubt upon the earth and upon their bodies, then they shriek in anger and horror. Now, what does this indicate? Well, I think it indicates that they are atheists and that they are materialists. Even if they think that they are, quote, spiritual, then they are what a certain Tibetan teacher called spiritual materialists. Well, now, after having thus knocked about some people and fulminated in my usual manner, I need to probably settle down a little bit at this point and bring a little bit closer Jung's position. Jung said about this issue of dualism, he said, "Gnosis is undoubtedly a psychological knowledge whose contents derive from the unconscious." And he defined it in more precise terms when he wrote, and I quote again, "Our aim is to create a wider personality whose center of gravity does not necessarily coincide with the ego, but which on the contrary may even thwart the ego tendencies. Like a magnet, the new center attracts to itself that which is proper to it, the signs of the Father," he uses a Gnostic term, "namely everything that pertains to the original and unalterable character of the individual ground plan. The same knowledge formulated differently to suit the age they lived in was possessed by the Gnostics." This is how he put it. So what are we dealing with here? A widening of the soul. Actually, Rudolf Steiner mentioned that term, das Weitwerden der Seele. Mm-hmm. The extension of that little circle of light that is around us and which is shed by our spirit but kind of carried forward by the little magician, our ego. This has to get wider. No longer being ego-centered, but the shifting of the psychological center of gravity to something that is beyond the ego. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, that's a little metaphor. Without gnosis, we are centered within our personal self. You know, it's sort of like a center of gravity that Newton spoke about, that the apple falls from the tree according to its center of gravity, that's what's going to hit the ground. So that is where our center of gravity is. But that center of gravity doesn't have to remain there. We don't have to remain the way we are. We don't have to stay within that small circle of light, just sort of circulating our own little light around and around, and not really include more than that. I'm not talking about intellectual inclusion now. Because you can take in ideas till the cows come home, you know, and that is not going to really widen your soul. The widening of the soul comes about, Jung would say, primarily by way of two things. And the first of those is the one that we've been talking about all evening. It's the reconciliation of the opposites. As soon as we are not caught in the constant tug of war of these opposites, good and evil, knowledge and ignorance, above and below, happiness and unhappiness, health and illness, going on and on and on, whatever it is, but we somehow have escaped that thraldom. We are not being pulled into their realm. We are not being pulled into their orbit. We are somewhere in between. Like those of you who are familiar with Kabbalah, like in the middle pillar. We are not bouncing back and forth between the Sephirot, in Kabbalistic terms, on the right hand, on the left hand pillar. We are on the middle pillar. And we have taken such useful, transformative, illuminative psychic energy as we were able to take from the opposites, and we brought it together. This is, of course, why Jung was so interested in alchemy, because that is very largely the alchemical principle, that the two come together and they fuse their energy and then something new comes about. And as we do that, we are moving toward wholeness, toward real totality. Now, Jung initially, as some of you probably know, when he was still in medical school and just about to get his doctorate, was involved in something that a lot of people were involved in at that time, and that was sort of spiritualistic type of activity. He had a young cousin, Helene Preiswerk, of his mother's family. I think that was, she was certainly a Preiswerk, I don't know whether, I think she was Helen. In any event, this girl could go into trances and then would make all kinds of utterances. It was in the family, and Jung sat there and wrote them all down. And this went on for a considerable period of time, and then later on they gave it up. Well, the material that came forth when Jung studied it and analyzed it revealed to him that what was taking place here to a major extent was that the girl had within herself unintegrated part selves. And these unintegrated part selves, psychological principles or complexes within her, seized upon the opportunity to masquerade as persons. And then they came forth. And that this very often happens in spiritualistic or channeling type of situations. And then he saw that what were they trying to do? Were they just trying to express themselves? No. What he found was they were trying to get together with each other and with her. And so he discerned that the objective of all of this drama that was going on was unification. The cessation of these internal divisions, which don't show on the surface. I'm sure the girl looked like a perfectly healthy Swiss girl, you know. But they all tried to get together. They tried to get together. So that was the first recognition, that unification is the ultimate objective. Well, ultimate objective as far as human psychology is concerned. And then, later on, you know, give it another, what would it have been? Yeah, another 20 years or so, 16, 20 years or so, because that was around 1900. The seven sermons were written around 1916. Then he came to see that not only was this unification an important issue, a very all-important issue, but that the oppositional forces within the psyche were trying to reconcile, and to facilitate the reconciliation is a very, very important step toward that union. Now, since I have to conclude once again, how does this relate to the Gnostic, the original Gnostic mythos? Let me say once again, as I hope it's not redundant, too redundant what I said before, it's a little irony. God doesn't want neurotics in heaven. And to translate it into Gnostic terms, you have to psychologically, psycho-spiritually get your act together before you are really ready for transcendence. Otherwise, you are just going from having been a secular not, you will have turned into a religious not. And just, you know, having converted to Jesus, as they call him on the Sunday night television, have you ever noticed that there is this, the way they pronounce the name reminds you of a certain dairy product, Jesus. Jesus. This born again and this, that, and the other thing will not do it. It may give the person a good feeling. It may even, you know, sort of tune them in for a while to something greater than themselves. But they have to come to a reconciliation of the opposites within themselves. They have to come to a union within themselves. Then they are ready for really great, liberating, final, ultimate gnosis. When you have become one, then you no longer belong into this world. Mm-hmm. When you have become one, then nothing in this world has any hold on you any longer. Not this opposite, not that opposite. You know? not the revolutionary opposite, let's say, of society. It says, hey, you know, you have to stick around and help us change society, help us change the world, you know, change. Or on the other hand, let's say a conservative notion, say, listen, buddy, you know, you have to stay here and help us defend the establishment, defend the structure. And you know what? When you are one, you say, oh yeah, well, you know, I have known you and I have known you. And I am no longer of your kingdom. I, as the soul says in the Pistis Sophia, when the archons of the planets come up and say, where are you going? Where are you going? You belong to me. He says, no, I no longer belong to you. I am now going to get my inheritance up above. But in order to be able to do that, you have to have become powerful, you have to have become strong spiritually as the result of this interior unification. Now, as I see it, and I certainly stand to be corrected only on that point, by the way. Don't try to correct me on anything else, will you? Just on that point. That this was really Jung's forte. He tried to create an insight and a discipline whereby that internal unification could be accomplished, which then would make people ready for the true ultimate liberating gnosis. And if he has indeed done something in that regard, and if we will discover yet more of the kind of insights and the kind of directions that he had from his unpublished writings, then I think we can be truly grateful to him for that, because that is a very, very great contribution. It's a signal contribution to the field of religion and a signal contribution to the field of the understanding of the psyche called psychology. So he has given us a great gift in both of these areas, and for that gift we can be and indeed should be eternally grateful. And how this expresses itself further and leads to that insight and that liberation, to that our next discussion will be devoted, until which time I bid you good night and I thank you very much.
Copyright MMD by BC Recordings. Catalog number 100903. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org.